Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Lyra, there's a great change coming that will threaten us all. I'm going to give you something.
What does it do?
It has a part to play in all this. And a major one.
Tell me where the alethiometer is.
I'll destroy all of this.
Hello and welcome to the one and only episode of Still Watching His Dark Materials. I'm Vanity Fair Senior Writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair Chief Critic Richard Lawson.
You may hear my demon, my familiar, my cat in the background this episode. I usually keep her elsewhere when we're recording, but full disclosure, she's been sick, so I'm letting her do whatever she wants right now. So
it's demon, not Damon.
Well, do they pronounce it as Damon in this episode?
I don't actually remember, weirdly, but I remember when I only started to read the book like years ago. I have never finished it, but that was my first thing I was confused about, my first of many.
I always pronounced it Damon in my head, and mm-hmm. And I think in the audiobooks that I've listened to, they've pronounced it Damon, but I've heard it's called Demon as well. Do we want to just decide on a pronunciation, and if we're wrong, we're wrong, but at least we'll be consistent? What do you want to do, Richard?
Well,
Damon? Demon?
I think in the
Matt
interest
Damon?
Of supporting cancel culture, we'd say Demon because Damon is semi-canceled. I don't know.
Yeah, he's half canceled. All right. So Matt Damon, it is. we are discussing the first episode of the new TV series, His Dark Materials, based on the novels, by Philip Pullman. This episode, season one, episode one, is Lyra's Jordan, directed by Tom Hooper, written by Jack Thorne. And we're going to talk about that. Richard has not read the books. I've read the books. This is a familiar setup to some of you guys.
I can't
we're not
read.
Gonna go... we're working on it. We're getting Richard some lessons. No, but we're not going to delve too deeply. You know, if you haven't read the books, or haven't seen the film that came out several years ago with Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig, and don't know the plot of the story, we're not going to get too deep, too deep into what you might consider a book spoiler. Until the end, we're going to talk more directly about a few things. So if you're trying to go in clean, this actually should be kind of a safe conversation for you. But if you want some deeper, juicier book stuff, we will get into that at the end with a warning for you guys to jump off. So that's our usual MO. This is our, like I said, our only episode of that we're covering His Dark Materials. The we have heard your pleas, your cries for us to cover more Watchmen. I think Richard and I both actually kind of want to do that. I don't want to spring that on you, but we're both like lamenting that we only got to do one episode of that. So we're gonna I'm gonna right now commit to keeping the door open to the possibility that we do like a wrap up episode or something like that.
I think I'd be game for that. I think just like the sort of semi boring behind the scenes how the sausage is made. It's just that this is like a crazy busy time of year for both of us and for VF in general. And so it has been a bit hard with this kind of onslaught of all these new shows this season. It's been a bit hard to commit to one, for this podcast. But yeah, we definitely have heard the clamor for more Watchmen. So hopefully we can honor that in some way.
Yeah. And as we mentioned, on the last podcast we did, we will be covering The Crown. We're going to do three special episodes around the release of season 3 of The Crown. That will drop, I believe those episodes will drop on the 15th and the 17th. The Crown debuts on the 17th Sunday. We'll have basically like a lead up episode on the 15th and then two episodes that release on the Sunday. So, with some great guests, we've got Julie Miller, who's like the queen of the crown on VF.com. We've got some historians we're going to be talking to. It's going to be a great royal time at Still Watching. And then, on the geekier side of things, Anthony Bresnikan, one of our newest hires, A new kid to the industry. No, Anthony, obviously a veteran, will be joining me to discuss The Mandalorian. And I believe that starts on the 14th of November and that will be weekly as well. So there'll be a lot of Still Watching, even if it isn't the exact show that you always want it to be. We wish we could do every single show for you. But if Richard and I can squeeze in, a Watchmen wrap up, we definitely absolutely will. I can just say you will be listening to this after episode 3 of Watchmen airs. And I guess all I will say, and Richard could say more if he wants, but all I will say is that when Richard was watching Screeners, he texted me to say, Jean Smart is amazing, isn't she? This is the Jean Smart episode. We're both big fans and she's incredible in that episode in the show. I think that's really when the show kicks into high gear is episode 3, when you're just like, you're comfortable enough in the world. And then Jean Smart comes in as this character that's a character from the original comics. And, it's just firing on all cylinders. And then how many, not to spoil anything, Richard, but how many, of the episodes of Watchmen did you wind up watching?
Everything I made available. So I think that was 6.
Right. So episode 6 is like incredible. So, mm-hmm. Maybe we'll come back to talk about episode 6. Maybe we'll come back to talk about the finale, but hope you're enjoying Watchmen. Sorry, we can't watch it all with you. We are watching His Dark Materials instead this week. So this is the trilogy of books that Philip Pullman, put out is The Golden Compass, The Subtle Knife, The Amber Spyglass. And he's in the midst currently of writing a new trilogy that takes place sort of around this trilogy called, the trilogy is called The Book of Dust. The first book in that trilogy is called La Belle Sauvage. And the second book is called The Secret Commonwealth. So that has some extra information. If you want to be the smuggest book reader, you can read those books too. They only a little bit inform this adaptation. This is mostly concerned with that original trilogy that he wrote, but stuff like that happens at the beginning of this episode, like the flood that you see Lord Asriel sort of fording his way through in order to drop the baby off at Oxford, that's from this new trilogy. So, there's just some like prequel stuff going to be laced in there, but not vital that you've read it if you want to be a book reader. But the most important thing that I want to talk about off the top with you, Richard, is what's tricky to pull off, and why you could not have had this adaptation many years ago and why they were only somewhat successful with it several years ago, is this concept of the Matt demons, the demons, these physical, corporeal embodiments of a bit of your soul, which as a child are changeable, And then become fixed as these sort of creatures that are tethered to you as adults. They're physically tethered to you. They can only go a certain distance from you. It's actually painful, if you're separated, too separated from your demon. And in this world that Philip Pullman has created, they become this lifelong companion. It's sort of like, you know, this incredible, I wish we had this, you know, and you're never lonely. You're never whatever. You've got this, like, this other thing. And this other thing is not just an extension of you. It's a character unto itself. And this, of course, requires incredible CG work. When I first saw this episode at Television Critics Association, summer press tour, a couple months ago, the CG work was not done. So the daemons were like these weird, like, you know, they weren't quite tennis balls, but, you know, the CG equivalent of that. So to see the finished product, I was much more impressed, though I'm not sure it gets me all the way where I was in the book, because in the book it's easy to sort of imagine it and suspend your disbelief. How do these creatures work for you, Richard, as someone who doesn't have that book experience?
Well, I think Lyra's, who has a name beginning with P that I'm not going to try to pronounce.
You can call him Pan.
Pan. Okay.
So Pan.
I think Lyra's works well, you know, even though they're constantly shifting from various species. When Lord Asriel, played by James McAvoy, appears and he has this like snow leopard demon, yeah. That to me felt a little bit closer to like Jon Favreau, Lion King, like why is this photorealistic thing talking, you know?
Yes.
So I think it is a tricky thing. I mean, I think the thing about it, that it's so constant, you know, it's not like, oh, once in a while, there's the demon. It's like, no, they're like there all the time. And so it's just
right
to do that kind of meticulous, thorough kind of CGI work for a television show. Like, I think it's mostly, impressive, but, also still a little jarring. Yeah.
Yeah, there's also Mrs. Coulter's golden monkey, Mrs. Coulter, who shows up, you know, sort of two-thirds of the way through the episode. She's got this golden monkey that I'm not sure the face. I don't know. I'll need to watch more. Full disclosure, I've only seen the first episode. But, like, I've seen it a couple times, but I've only seen the first episode. Yeah, I almost wonder if it would have been better. You know, like, you need Lord Asriel's snow leopard Stelmaria to talk. You need Pantalaimon to talk. You need them all to talk. That's an important part of the story. But I almost wonder if they could have done it with like a voice, but you don't see the mouths move. The mouths moving is what's really odd sometimes.
Yeah.
Especially, I think you're right with Stelmaria. So, Yeah. It's better. And it's interesting because like Pantalaimon, who's Lyra's, Daemon, is such an important part of the book that, and such a character unto himself that, you know, they have to ramp it down a little bit, even, you know, you're like, they're constantly there. And I'm like, yes, but still less so than the book. So, you know, by the nature of the medium that they're doing, I understand it. But, yeah, that's the, I think it's the trickiest, one of two very tricky challenges in this story. The other tricky challenge that the movie completely failed to clear, as far as I'm concerned, is getting you to really care for and connect with these characters. I mean, Lyra being our main entree into this world, you know, so that you're with them even as you're adjusting to this slightly off our reality. So how the casting of Daphne Keene, I think, is an incredible choice. She was so good in Logan. She's mostly nonverbal in Logan, but like, she's so good in Logan. I think she's quite good here. What do you think of her Lyra?
No, I think she's good. I think it's strong casting. She's a good actress. But in a more general sense, in terms of getting to know and like these characters while also being, served a heap of exposition, I kind of wanted this episode to move a bit more slowly, actually.
Yeah.
I kind of found it a little dull in all its swiftness, because I was like, wait, I can't grab onto anything because these scenes just keep moving with the eagerness of a child. And I get that it's about a child, but it should be told by an adult, you know? It just felt very like, you know, rolling very fast and collecting information as it went. So I found it a little hard to engage. You know, I'm certainly curious about what's to come, but, having not, read the book and barely remembering the movie, But yeah, I don't know. I found it a little hard to kind of dive into this world as lovingly, you know, on a technical level as it is crafted.
Yeah, you know, so it's 8 episodes in this first season, which is obviously much more room than the film had. But I agree with you. I think it's like, I can't believe she's already leaving with Mrs. Coulter by the end of episode 1. That feels so fast to me. And I think of Game of Thrones. You think of the pilot of Game of Thrones, which I, you know, in its final version, I think is a really good episode of television, and something that should be studied in terms of getting you to care about character, a large cast of characters you haven't met and a world that you're unfamiliar with. And it's because it takes its time. The pilot episode of Game of Thrones is essentially, an old friend visits his friend's home for dinner. That's the first episode of Game of Thrones. And yeah, a kid falls from a tower, but like that's basically the first episode. One family visits another family for dinner and you get to meet those families. And so if like just Lord Asriel's visit was our introduction to Oxford, and Lyra and her world there, it's called Lyra's Oxford because that's what the section, or Lyra's Jordan College, because that's, I think that's what the section of the book's called, or it's called Lyra's Oxford. I can't remember, but, you're meant to get to know this world before she leaves it for her adventure, because you always need to know on these, you know, classic Joseph Campbell hero's journey, you always need to know what the hero's protecting before they leave. So you need to understand what the Shire is, right, before the hobbits leave, so that you know what they're fighting for. So you need to know what Lyra is trying to protect in the world of Oxford, of Jordan College. And I don't think we really get that from this episode.
Like,
at all.
I almost feel like this, the pilot episode of this could end with Lyra peering through the window and seeing the master pouring the poison into the wine. And
ooh,
so thus,
yeah,
you know, kind of introducing that there is darkness and moral complexity in this world. And then, but you know, in the previous 58 minutes, just taking the time to really set up in organic ways, the terms of the world, who everyone is, what the demons are, without, you know, kind of over explaining it, like, you know, not to tell talented people how to do their jobs, but it just feels like a little bit, I don't know, I wanted a bit more texture, much in the way we got in the Game of Thrones pilot. And I guess everything like this will be compared to that show for the foreseeable future, which is maybe unfair, but yeah, it's a stark contrast. Stark.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Well, I mean, the thing is, the person adapting these books this time around is Jack Thorne, who, you know, is a playwright. It has a long list of credits, but his most famous credit is that he wrote the stage play for Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, which people are sharply divided on, and I would say a lot of Harry Potter fans are vehemently against. And I think for this sort of similar reason, that's obviously a shorter form adaptation than this is, but because, you know, for better or for worse, what J.K. Rowling was really good at, and what Philip Pullman is really good at, is world building and letting you just really sit in that world and understand it and understand all the texture of it. And I think Cursed Child just zips through this like time travel plot that like doesn't let you feel, I don't know, the Quidditch games or the whatever it is you need to feel like to feel like you're in this world. And I think that's similar for Lyra's her Jordan College in Oxford. And I think one of the things that they have expanded for this adaptation that I really like is the Egyptian culture, the Egyptian characters. We get this in this episode, we get this sort of coming of age rite of passage with one of the Egyptian boys. The Egyptians are the you know, itinerant Romani sort of figures in the show, in this world. And Tony Costa is the name of the kid who's sort of coming of age, and we see this whole ceremony before his younger brother Billy goes missing, and that's a big like thrust for the Egyptians. But that coming of age thing is not in the book, and I think they are really wanting to build out the Egyptians in a way that I think is cool. I think it opens up the world to be not just Lyra's point of view, but this other point of view as well. And so, as you say, like, if you're gonna do that, if you're gonna open up the Egyptians, which I think you should, then yes, just spend more time here in Oxford in Jordan, getting to know the Costas, getting to know Fadakorum, getting to know all of their culture before we leave, you know?
Yeah, and like, I don't know, these days aren't sort of prestige cable viewers pretty patient, you know? Like, I think a lot of us are used to kind of waiting for something to reveal itself slowly. I don't think we need it to, you know, it feels almost like a network pilot in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what I worry about then, is that, the show might be impatient to get to the action. And as with Game of Thrones, like, I feel like any story that's impatient to get to the action doesn't really understand why we care about the action in the first place, which is the characters and the world, do you know?
So, yeah, exactly.
All right. So, you know, you and I are of a similar mind about that. But something I do want to very much praise, heap a lot of praise on, is James McAvoy's performance as Lord Asriel. Because this is a really hard character, I think, to embody. Once again, Daniel Craig played him in the film a few years ago. Lord Asriel, is, you know, the one family member that Lyra is aware of in this world. And, he needs to be imperious and cold and reserved and removed. But at the same time, like, someone that you're, I don't know, there has to be a warmth with the cold. And I think James McAvoy is incapable of delivering like a pure cold performance. There's just something about him as a performer where you're always drawn into what he's doing, even if it is, as brusque as Lord Asriel can be in this episode. Are you with me on that, Richard? Like, where are you on the McAvoy of it all?
Yeah, no, I mean, he's always a welcome actor to me. Like, I pretty much like him in everything, maybe minus a couple of the many characters he plays in Glass or
sure.
The other one.
Split,
thank you. I think it would be nice if we had more time just to kind of sit with him and really kind of see the nuances of his relationship with his niece. I trust that McAvoy, you know, saw something interesting in the material that he wanted to, you know, however dark it may be, to do it, you know, and maybe that means further scripts or whatever. But, I like him in it because he implies like the sort of excitement and danger of the bigger world. He kind of, you know, rushes in with this, you know, blast of kind of Arctic air. Like it's good. Having someone of that level of fame play the part, I think it works because it makes him loom that much larger in both Lyra's and our estimation, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Like the rest of the cast, it's a great cast, we should say, but like a lot of the Oxford Dons and the, you know, the Egyptians are like Game of Thrones character actors that I recognize. You know what I mean? That's the level that we're talking about there to a certain degree, with the exception of Anne-Marie Duff, McAvoy's real-life ex-wife, who plays Ma Costa, and I think does a great job as this woman who's lost her child and is sort of frantic and anxious about it. But that, you know, it's to have a world populated by mostly character actors, even Ruth Wilson, who's, you know, been in some incredible television, is a television actress, right? But James McAvoy is, you know, is more of a movie star. And so you're right, to have him come in that role is you sit up and pay attention, and you're glammed by him as the way that, like, the Oxford needs to be glammed by him. And you're talking about the impatience of this episode, the rush of it. And I agree with a lot of that, but I think the impatience and the rush of Asriel works. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, I got what I need. I gotta go. Like, dirigible in, dirigible out. I'm gone, you know, sort of thing. So, and I think a lot of that's down to McAvoy, which brings us to Ruth Wilson, who's playing, Mrs. Coulter, Marissa Coulter. This is the role played by Nicole Kidman in the film. And, this is a woman who's supposed to be, like, extremely charming, extremely glamorous. I think Ruth Wilson is a fascinating choice for this role. Like, Nicole Kidman, I think, is very, obvious perfect casting for this. And I think Ruth Wilson is a little off, the expected. And I actually am quite excited by that. What did you think of her debut here?
Yeah, I like her. I never watched, Luther, where she was, kind of, I guess, the villain on that. I certainly saw The Lone Ranger, which she is in. and then The Affair, I kind of wasn't that interested in. So I wasn't really sure what to make of her. But then I saw her in King Lear, that Glenda Jackson did on Broadway, and she played two parts. She played, Cordelia, one of the daughters of Lear, but also the fool. And she was, like, really incredible. And showed a real versatility of range. So, and I think, you know, this role is a good example of that she can play different shades. You know, she's done a lot of, more, you know, sort of wide-eyed innocent stuff, villainous stuff in Luther. And now this is kind of this mix of warmth and not warmth. And, I think she's good. And I, you know, like, again, all these big names signing on, it makes me think, like, oh, maybe there's something more to come. Like, isn't Lin-Manuel Miranda showing up at some point? Like, you know, I hope that there was a vision communicated to all these actors that we have yet to see.
Yeah, so that's the casting I'm actually the most concerned about, is Lin-Manuel Miranda as Lee Scoresby. Lee Scoresby is played by Sam Elliott in the original film, and I really genuinely cannot think of more perfect casting on this planet. There's a few things they got really right with the film. One was Sam Elliott as Lee Scoresby. And the other was Eva Green as Serafina Pecola, this, like, witch, the head of the witches. Once you've got an Eva Green, it's really hard to, like, cast someone else as your head witch. But to go from Sam Elliott to Lin-Manuel Miranda, who, though, I really like him, I think he's a genius at many things that he does. He's been an amazing, like, hype man for the show. I just don't think he's a tremendously good or versatile actor.
Yeah.
I just don't think he is. He's not even a very good singer, you know, like he's got stage presence. He was incredibly good at Hamilton in a role that, like, just matched his talents very well. Hamilton, of course, I think is a work of, like, writing genius, but as a performer, you know, like, I think he stuck out like a huge sore thumb in the Mary Poppins film. And I'm concerned that it'll be the same case here. Scoresby is this, American cowboy, aeronaut figure, who comes and helps Lyra at a certain point. Yeah. And, it's a Sam Elliott role. It's not a Lin-Manuel Miranda role, you know, it just isn't. So it's not fair. I haven't seen it yet. I haven't seen him in the role yet. He might be great. But I'm incredibly nervous about that casting. So,
yeah. So, like, let's just, can we like zoom back a little bit and just for my benefit and maybe some people listening and just kind of like set the table for this world? Because so it's like, it's an alternate dimension sort of. It's like, I guess the title cards at the beginning say it's like our world, but not our world. Right.
Right.
And so there is this, obviously Oxford exists. But there is a presiding thing, over them, the magisterium that they are concerned about, which is kind of a religious order. Is that correct?
Yes. It's like the church.
Right.
A church government.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And then there are the Egyptians who are sort of canal people. I guess my question is, how much weirder is this going to get? You know, does it, you mentioned witches and, you know, I know there's other things to come. Because this is a this is like real a fantasy kind of thing, right? Sci-fi.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, you're starting with the fantasy. I would call it more fantasy than sci-fi. You're starting with these demons. Number one, main difference, I would say. There's also a difference in like technology, because it takes like, you know, we're talking about multiple worlds ultimately in this series. And so this is supposed to be a contemporary world to our world, time-wise.
Right.
But it seems more antiquated. It seems older because the technology is different. So there's the demons, there's the technology, there's witches, there's these armored bears, Panzerbjörnen, I think they're called, which are, you know, bears that, like demons, can, like, talk and have their own culture, their own, like, they wear armor. It's a whole thing. And then you have this concept of dust, which is what Lord Asriel is talking about a bit in this episode. And dust has to do with this idea of, like, original sin and the innocence of children. And there's a scientific element to it. You know, Asriel talks about it as if it's, you know, these particles, these dust particles. But it's also spiritual, because it has to do with, like, innocence. And, you know, if you think about Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and how they were innocent before they ate the fruit, and you think about children and their innocence before, you know, they go through puberty. So this idea is tied to, like, once you go through puberty and your demon is fixed to a certain thing, you have lost your innocence in a certain way. It's not as one-to-one as, like, if you lose your virginity or whatever, you know, then your demon is fixed. It's not quite like that, but it has to do with, like, an age of maturation, puberty sort of thing. So it's tied with, like, sex and childhood and so, you know, what children can see, what adults can see, what children are open to, what adults are open to. So, like, Asriel is interested in harnessing some of that energy in order to try. They mentioned in this episode, a city in the sky, is something that he's kind of after. So that's, I don't know. I kept it, like, slightly vague for people, but hopefully that orients us in this world. You know what I mean? So, like, our world, but different, but older, but slower, certainly no cell phones.
In this episode, we see two sort of reactions to, well, I mean, we see more than two, but, like, two main reactions to what Asriel kind of comes back from the north to talk about. One is that, I guess even before he speaks, the master, played by Clark Peters, tries to kill him. Even though he seems like otherwise a kind of kindly character who cares for Lyra. And then we see these two people at the Magisterium sort of talking a bit more grandly about. So my question for you is, what is threatening about what Asriel's saying to both the master and the people of the Magisterium?
Yeah, that's a great question. So as far as the Magisterium is concerned, I think Asriel is interested in, like, I think it's safe to say that what Asriel is after is concrete proof of God's existence, whether or not God exists. And that is sort of counter to the interests of the Magisterium, right? Because it's not about science for them, right? It's about faith and what that faith, the power that faith confers to them as sort of, you know, leaders in that faith community, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you think of religion, I mean, this is why, you know, we should say these books were incredibly controversial when they came out. And then the film itself was incredibly controversial for certain members of the church, because obviously the church is rather villainous in this series. And it gets a little too concrete for comfort with ideas of God and what it means and who God is and what God is interested in. So I think, you know, this is Pullman's answer to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I think he's talked about that. The Narnia books, which are fantasy tied up in faith, in that way. And he's like, what about fantasy tied up in atheism a bit more? And, or at least agnosticism. And that's interesting to me. He's basically, it's so hard to explain, but it's like this concept of free will. The master, I think, is less threatened by that directly and more concerned with this prophecy that he's aware of that Lyra is involved with. And I think he's just trying to like nip it in the bud. And, yes, basically Azrael's radical attempts to define and explore and probe into this world of religion and spirituality, is threatening to the status quo. But I think more than anything, these men that you meet at Oxford who have raised Lyra are above everything concerned about Lyra. And so I think the idea of killing Azrael, which, you know, the master is not a villain, but killing Azrael to sort of protect Lyra, I think was, and to stop whatever he's putting in motion with his experiments, with his investigations. Does that make sense?
It totally does. Yes. Thank you. I feel like that clears up, certain motivations for me. Cause I think that this episode, like, again, in introducing so much information, it's like, wait, I wanted to pause on that point. Like, I want to say more about that. Like, and I don't know. I'm hoping in the next episode that the show takes a deep breath and is like, okay, so we got that out of the way. Now we can just settle into a story. But I don't know. It seems like there's a lot of story to tell in this saga. So maybe it's going to be kind of a jumble for a while.
There's a lot to do, and I can't help but think this season really could have stood to be 10 episodes, but mm-hmm. I think 10 episodes is kind of the like American shortened version, and this is primarily a UK show, it's a BBC show, and so I think 8 episodes is sort of like, they often do 6, right?
Right.
8 is like kind of long for them, so I think, you know, to stretch it to 10 maybe feels ridiculous to them. But I'm like, we could use those extra 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And it's my understanding, you know, they're going to do the whole trilogy. Amber, they're already, you know, have shot or are shooting the second Subtle Knife. The second season, and they're trying to do it quickly because kids grow, right?
Yeah.
But it's my understanding that some of the Subtle Knife, which introduces another protagonist, will be pulled into the end of this first season. Like, we're going to meet some of the characters that only show up in season 2 at the end of this season. I think just to make it feel like sometimes the second book can feel like a full restart.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're just trying to like sort of soft lead it in from this season. So maybe that's part of their hurry, cause they're trying to get to the second book already by the end of the first season. But yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, the Magisterium, and the idea of a villainous church state, or at least, a church state that is heavily invested in keeping people in the dark, is a lot of what this book is concerned about, is concerned with. And the idea of free will, mm-hmm. and the choice of the humans on this planet, to do what they want to do and not, you know, adhere to what a god, a distant and, you know, unloving god wants or, you know, his representatives here on Earth want. So,
yeah, I mean, it definitely sets up a clear, dichotomy between the academy and the church, you know, like,
right,
which
right.
is a pretty strong, you know, evidence that Pullman is like, okay, like I kind of am doing a reason versus faith thing here.
Right.
And it might be sort of clear which side I'm on.
Yes.
But I wonder, I'm curious to see how like viewers, you know, of varied sort of faith backgrounds will respond to that. My hunch is that, you know, diehard Catholics who, would be upset by the show will probably already be familiar in some sense of what Pullman's kind of ultimate argument is, which I have read a little bit about. So maybe they'll stay away regardless, but I don't know. I'd be curious to see if there are like think pieces about this.
Yeah. I mean, it almost feels like we already did this when the movie came out. There was so many protests and stuff like that. And I just kind of feel like, you know, the movie landed and it just wasn't a big deal. And so I almost feel like it would be silly for us to just have the whole fight over again when like the movie landed and no one cared and it was just sort of like, whatever. You know, and I also feel like, this many years removed. Do you remember when the Harry Potter books came out? There was like a lot of, you know, religious outcry over Harry Potter and how it was like evil and encouraging, you know, satanic worship or, you know, paganism or whatever. And, you know, I feel like the church definitely lost that argument. And you have this generation that was raised on Harry, like, we can't underestimate this entire generation that was raised on Harry Potter. And what that does to how we think about fantasy in general, what that generation who is, you know, they're the millennials, right? Like millennials, are the Harry Potter generation. They all read those books or saw those movies. So it wasn't like fantasy was just for like the nerds who are reading Narnia or whatever. Like everyone read Harry Potter. Everyone watched those movies. And so like you're dealing with a different, an audience that's trained to think about these things a little differently. I don't know. I just always think about that. I feel like we'll never, we have yet to really fully grapple with what everyone reading Harry Potter meant for the culture, you know? So,
right. Yes. Yeah, so exactly.
But Philip Pullman is the benefit. All right. So let's dive in. I mean, like, let's go and talk about some of those larger things that you've read a Wikipedia summary about, Richard. And I have some book specific things I want to talk about, but that's like, you know, our general sense of this first episode is, a little rush for our taste. The design is almost there, but maybe not quite. Some good casting, really good casting. Mm-hmm. And our hope that it sort of takes a breath, slows down, and lets the rest of this adventure sort of unspool at a bit more leisurely pace. So,
yeah.
All right. Okay. So if you have not read the books or don't want to hear any book discussion, deep books discussion beyond what we've already discussed, now is the time to hop off. Richard and I are just going to touch on a few things really quickly. So Richard, what did you read in this, Wikipedia summary that,
well, it's not just a Wikipedia summary, but like, you know, yeah. I have several good friends who are deeply devoted to these books.
Yeah.
My understanding is ultimately that this is kind of about trying to kill God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that'll be interesting once that actually becomes manifest. And I guess in reading summaries and talking to friends, what seems interesting about this series, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that Asriel does bad things, particularly one bad thing, at the end of this book or the first book. And Coulter does bad things, but maybe they're not all bad. Is that right?
It's like a for the greater good thing, or also like Mrs. Coulter, you know, I mean, spoiler alert. Sorry. I just knocked something over. Spoiler alert. Asriel and Mrs. Coulter are Lyra's actual parents, right?
Right.
And so a lot of what Mrs. Coulter does, not everything, but a lot of what she does, is to protect Lyra. And ultimately Asriel does similar. And, he basically, like, he doesn't see, like, you know, he kills Roger. That's awful. And like this kid who plays Roger is so sweet and lovely in this first episode. And like, he kills Roger in pursuit of this experiment. You know, he kind of feels like this. It's like what we talked about with Succession, right? Roger's a kitchen boy. He's not a real kid, right?
Right.
He's not a real person. He's expendable for this experiment that Asriel feels like is ultimately going to be extremely important for humanity. But Lyra's different. Lyra's his kid. And as cold as he is to her in this episode, this first episode, he's also at least somewhat tender to her. He doesn't want her to go because it's actually literally dangerous for her to go up to the Arctic, where they are like separating children from their demons in order to figure out, harness energy and figure out dust and all that sort of stuff. He does not want her up there because it is too dangerous for her.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, yeah, in the end, they sacrifice themselves, you know, for Lyra, for the greater good. And so in the end, yeah, they are, not purely villainous, characters. But what's fascinating about the Ruth Wilson casting is I do think if you watch this first episode alone, you don't necessarily know she's a villain, except for the fact that her monkey is pretty creepy. But like, she doesn't play it quite the way that Nicole Kidman did. And I like that about her, because that is Mrs. Coulter. She needs to be able to basically code switch and like be very just charming and then just like ice cold when she decides she wants to be ice cold. And Ruth Wilson is incredible at that. No one turns on a dime faster than she does. So I think that's very good casting for her. And I think McAvoy too can contain those multitudes of Azrael, who's a very complicated character. You think he's the villain, and then you're like, oh, I'm not so sure. Actually, God's the villain. Let's kill God.
Right.
This is a fun book series. And I don't mean that to like offend anyone who is religious or spiritual and listening. Like, cause I think it's possible for Philip Pullman to wrestle with his ideas of God and religion, to wrestle with his idea of a God that feels worth killing in order to liberate humanity. Maybe this is naive of me to say, but without taking it entirely personally to your own faith, because this is his perception of religion. But I'm not sure, even as someone who's a fan of these books, I would say that this is should be the perception of religion. Do you know?
Right. Yeah. It's more, seems like it's more about a certain kind of organized religion, you know, and the sort of, institutional bureaucratic thing. And I guess, yeah, to the figurehead of that would be the God. So like, but, I don't know. It's never been my impression that it's like an all out attack on any sort of faith. It's more just like about a kind of more rigidly institutional one, maybe.
Well, I mean, I think that Pullman is, I don't want to speak for him, and I'm not a Pullman scholar. My perception of him, based on what I do know, is that like, if you're religious and your faith is important to you, and you are cool with letting other people live their lives the way that they want to live their lives, that Philip Pullman would be cool with you. And what he's calling to task here is exactly what you're saying, Richard, that kind of like, you know, a religion that, demands other people, obey the rules that they have decided for the world, beyond a general sort of kindly do unto others sort of morality. But when you get into like deciding who people can like love or marry or whatever, you know, stuff like that, that is not okay. And I agree with Philip Pullman about that. So, you know, I'm perfectly okay with these books. there are these great angel characters. And that's the thing, is like, there are these angel characters that we'll meet later on that, are like sympathetic to the human cause. And so in that way represent a kind of spirituality that is, you know, is on the side of the heroes, if that makes sense. And yeah. So in that way, I don't feel like he's attacking all of religion everywhere. So, anything else I want? Yeah. So, to be a little bit more specific, Will Perry, who's sort of the protagonist that we meet, who's from our world, our modern, world, and finds his way to where Lyra is going to be introduced by the end of this season.
Right.
So, and then it becomes this is Lyra's book. Then we meet Will, and then it becomes a two-hander between them. It's the Will and Lyra show. So, you know, that casting will be very interesting, and we'll see where all of that goes. But I think that they've done a really good job of is in this first episode, for all my critiques, is underline the danger of this world, which is not like it's a fun story about a girl going on an adventure and she meets some talking polar bears. Like, that's all true. But at the end of this book, like, a kid dies, and it's very awful. And like, that's the world this book is dealing with. And so I think the series does a good job of setting up that danger right from the jump, with like making the disappearance of Billy Costa and the disappearance of Roger, land a bit harder than I think that they do, in the book. you know,
well, it sets them up as more like plot lines, right? Like now, does the Anne Marie Duff character, like with the, you know, with the whole, like, you know, demon ceremony and all that, like, it seems like they're setting her off on her own plot. Would that stray from the book? Does the book focus on her at all?
Well, no, basically, like, Lyra figures out that Mrs. Coulter is, involved in the snatching of the children, which she is. And so she runs away from her and she joins up with Egyptians.
I see. Okay.
So they take her in and so they take her north. So she basically like runs away from, Mrs. Coulter probably by the end of the next episode and then hops on the ships with the Egyptians. So they need to be, so they go, that happens in the book. It's just sort of like they're just there to teach Lyra how to use the compass and like help ferry her north, basically, as these right. sort of like mystical gypsy figures. Mm. And so I think it's really good to give them more of their own story. You know, like basically they conflated a few missing Egyptian children into one kid, Billy Costa.
Right.
But to focus it, I think that actually makes it better because it just gives it like one really strong coherent story of like, this is the loss that the Egyptian community is dealing with specifically. They have their own mission, their own reason for being there, and they're not just there to help Lyra. And I think, you know, sometimes, I mean, Daphne Keene isn't exactly like the blonde haired, actress who played Lyra in the movie, but like, you know, I think sometimes this can happen in books where like, the more quote unquote colorful characters are all just there to help the little like
right.
white protagonist along. And so, I think I really like that they're giving the Egyptians a little bit more of like sinking their roots a little bit deeper in the
yeah.
story. I like that.
Yeah. And I feel like that's also maybe crucial for a television series that's going to kind of exist for at least a couple seasons, like, is to have that a sturdy base of characters and stuff, just in case they end up straying from the books at all. Maybe they don't need to because there's enough material and they've got the 3-season plan or whatever it is. But, you know, you never know. If it's a huge hit, they'll probably want to keep going.
I mean, yeah, and Philip Pullman is writing these other books, which involve like a grown-up Lyra and stuff like that. So they could, you know, do that if they wanted to. But yeah, it's interesting to me. I also like the way that this show is cast. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it racially, because like this is modern Oxford, for as like retrograde as it might feel sometimes. And so I'm glad that, you know, not all of our characters, like Lord Boreal or the Master or whatever, are white. You know what I mean? Like, it's I think the BBC is really good at that, at casting to reflect the realities of what the UK looks like now. And as much as the UK might be grappling with like all of its Brexit xenophobia, like, that's something I've always been like, I noticed, I don't know, back when I started watching Doctor Who, is I was just like, there's just this casual way of inclusion in the way that they cast things that American TV really struggles with, especially with like period material. And so this feels like a period material. And so I could understand the impulse to cast it purely white. And I think the film pretty much did. So I'm glad to see, you know, for that reason, I'm glad to see Lin-Manuel Miranda in the cast mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. So, you know. All right. Is there anything else we want to talk about, in terms of this show or, future of the show?
Not for me. I mean, I think that just having it explained a little bit more, makes me curious to see the next episode and see what they do. But yeah, I was hoping to be like really taken by this pilot and I just wasn't, which is, you know, it does seem to be kind of the critical consensus, at least from people I follow, that like it's, it looks great. It has potential. And yet something about it just doesn't feel, it's not gripping.
I kind of feel that way about a lot. Like, I felt that way about Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which was another BBC adaptation of a great, fantasy tome, that came out, several years ago. I just feel like there's, something not quite like the production design is all there, all of that's in place. This is definitely better than the film, way better. I really like Daphne Keene in this role a lot. I don't know. There's moments like Roger screaming at an airship, "She's special, you know?" And Azrael being like, "We're all special." And it's like, oh, that's kind of part of the thesis of the show. But like, it feels kind of silly. It doesn't feel quite right. Whereas like some of the Lyra stuff feels very like Roger being like, "I brought you an extra sausage," and then like sitting and sharing breakfast and stuff like that. I think that's like that kind of like sunken normalcy feels like really, really good. But then there's just some other stuff that, yeah, it just doesn't feel, you know, if I had to pick between two, you know, if you and I were deciding right now what to cover, I would pick Watchmen over this.
Handily. Oh yeah. Yeah. Me too.
So, you know, there we are. But hopefully it will just get better and better. That would be nice. We all want these things to be great.
Sometimes pilots are shaky. Right. You never know.
Yes, it's true. And like, oh, trust me, you're all glad that you're seeing this, with the, special effects finished.
Right.
You know, I get it. HBO didn't even want to show it to us, I think, with the special effects the way they were. And I understand why. And so I don't want to knock them too hard because they did at least show it to us. And that was nice of them. But yeah, they were not ready to show it to us. So we will be back for The Crown and The Mandalorian and maybe some more Watchmen. Richard, until then, where can people find you?
Hiding on James McAvoy's airship, which is a euphemism for something. I don't really know what, but, and I'll be tweeting at Rylaws and writing for VF.com. And where will you be until we meet again?
Oh, I will definitely be on one of those Egyptian, ships. They look really fun. Those like longboats, yeah. Those houseboats.
Taking a casual cruise down the canal in Oxford.
Yeah. Give me a bird demon. That's something I didn't mention, but like all Egyptian demons are birds. I like that. Same with the witches. Because it would get very crowded if you had all those like other demons on your boat. So I'll just be like, you know, lathering on the eyeliner and joining the Egyptians on the boats and having a great time. And you can find both of us on vanityfair.com. You can find us on the podcast Little Gold Men, and Richard and I will be back talking about Buckingham Palace when we see you next time.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now. From PRX.